UK Wine Show, show number 216. Simon Tam on Chinese Wine. Mi hao and hello to you all. My name's Chris Scott and I hope this week went well for you. The balmy weather in the old UK has changed and we've had rain, more rain and rain. The weather's been quite breezy and blustery. Not the great weather, but at least the grass on the green where we live is starting to turn back to green after that brown colour. This week we're going to be talking to Simon Tam on Chinese wine. Simon is a wine educator in Hong Kong and he does a lot of wine education in Hong Kong and mainland China. And we're going to be talking to him all about the different regions in China, grape varieties, and what the issues are for Chinese wine. As usual, we have a fun-packed show, and we're going to start the show off this week with our mystery wine region. As usual, I'm going to give you a clue now, a clue before the interview, and then the answer at the end of the show. So, the first clue for our mystery wine region is our mystery region is in France's western Loire Valley, centered around the town of Angers. It's flat area with low rainfall and relatively mild climate. Influenced by the Atlantic, but is protected by the woods of Vendée to the southwest. A wide variety of grapes are grown, producing red, whites and rosé, producing a range from dry to the finer sweet wines coming from Côte de Lyon. Overall, less than 15% of the vineyards are white wine production, despite white wine being the focus until the 19th century. Ponder that for a while. I'll give you another clue after the news, which is coming up next with Jane.
Cheers, Chris. Bordeaux from previous vintages to the 2009 en primeur market can be better value. That's according to LiveX, the company whose index keeps tabs on price movements throughout the fine wine market. A study of 22 leading chateaux found that on average, the 2009s are trading at a 30% premium to the 2005s and a touch above the 2000s. They say it makes it the most expensive currently available vintage, bar 1982, despite it being 2 years away from delivery. Even at this early stage, the 2009s look fully, if not overpriced, and those in search of investment opportunities are likely to find better value elsewhere.
Is Bordeaux overpriced? On quality terms, of course. It's easy to find better quality wines at much cheaper prices. Just take a look at any critic scores and prices of non-Bordeaux wines. There are loads of cheaper wines out there. But Bordeaux pricing is not about pricing on quality. It never has been. It's a luxury good, and as such, prices are set by supply and demand. What this article is saying is that at the moment, the chateaux think the world economy is strong enough to take another step up in price. But what normally happens is that when you release a new wine at these new eye-watering prices, the old wines rise with them. Not this time, or at least not yet. China has shown this year that it's not the on-premier market that the Bordelais had hoped for. That's not to say they're not eventually going to buy these expensive wines, just not an on-premier. And the US is not buying up big? That leaves Old Blighty, and from what I've read, there seems to be some volume going through. But as larger tranches are released, will the prices hold up? I think in the end, what it shows is that if the old vintages are not rising in price, but the new ones are setting a high price on very low volumes, I have very little confidence that those prices are sustainable. What's the next story, Jane?
Well, sales of rosé wine have grown by 21.4% in value in the past year, according to the Wine and Spirit Trade Association, and volume has risen by 18.4%. This is striking when compared to the fact that sales of other wines in bars, clubs and restaurants are down over the course of the year. Several factors may have boosted rosé's popularity. Firstly, the recent good weather that we've had. And secondly, a growth in the £6 to £7 and £9 to £10 price ranges, which suggests that whilst consumers may be cutting back elsewhere, the attraction of a better bottle of wine at home is tempting the wine drinker to spend a little more. That's according to the research. There's also been a recovery in champagne with the off-trade ahead by 12.5% in volume and 7.7% in value.
In tastings, I often describe rosé as a red wine that didn't quite make it. And often rosé is made from young vines that can't produce good red wines yet. If you want to try a couple of really cracking English rosés, try Bidden in Rosé or Chapel Down English Rosé. These are two wines that are far superior to what you'll find on many supermarket shelves. With low yields and no climate for red wine, England produces some great rosé and certainly worth a try. What's the last story, Jane?
Finally this week, Amazon, America's largest online retailer, is now selling wine online. They were due to launch their wine arm in October 2008, but had to stop development, blaming regulatory barriers to shipping alcoholic drinks in the US. But now the company have acquired a Texas-based web business called Woot, that's W-O-O-T, who are famed for their dealer-day selling technique. Consumers can now choose from 22,000 grocery products online. The UK launch comes shortly after the company began offering fresh food and household products in Germany, which is the only other European market where it's introduced a grocery site so far. That's it from me this week, but do check out our website with these stories at www.3050.co.uk.
Cheers, Jane. The company Amazon bought sells wines with labels such as a bag of crap. So it's good to know where in the quality structure they're going for. But in an article I read, they apparently joke about being profitable in 2043, has a Ryanair style of disdain for complaints. Crap wine, poor customer service. This isn't a brand that I want to buy stuff from. Amazon sell everything, but one thing they almost certainly don't sell at the moment is natural wine. And that is what our spotlight is all about. So next up, let's find out about natural wine. Natural wine is, by some accounts, an extreme movement at producing a natural wine. It's sort of in the name. The thing that most people don't like is that it implies that all other wines are not natural. But in natural wine, nothing is added or removed by the winemaker. Well, that's one definition. Others may say that very small amounts of sulfur dioxide may be added. Others again say that racking is okay. Racking's when you move the wine from one barrel to the other and leave sediment behind. And this is the key problem defining natural wine. It has no rules, no governing body, or certification system. While there's a lack of rules, the movement is very, very small and is based on an ideal. So personal integrity of those making the wine is probably the key aspect. Those buying the wines are more likely to know about the producer's methods of production than buyers of the more mainstream and much larger organic wine movement, for example. Unlike organics, which are focused on growing the grapes, natural wine is focused in the winery and the winemaking process. The wines are likely to be made from low-yielding, hand-picked organic or biodynamic grapes, but in the winery, it's more about what's not added. No sugar, acidity, or introduced yeasts, with sulfates very, very limited. And for some, taken to the extreme case, no sulfates at all. The process is decidedly low-tech, without any filtering or fining, and certainly no micro-oxidization, reverse osmosis, or spinning cones. The key guideline is the wine is made with as little human, chemical, or technological intervention as possible. However, winemakers use these tools and processes to create wines with a higher quality and consistency. The concept of natural wine is to let the wine make itself, and in doing so, the wine will show its terroir or somehow be better for you. The problem with natural wine is that wine is a man-made product. Decisions are made in the winemaking process that have a massive influence on the wine. Decisions such as when to pick, whether to destem, or even to remove diseased fruit. In the winery, decisions are constantly made, such as what type of fermentation vessel, to use temperature control, the length of skin contact, and even oak aging. So even if all the high-tech tools are removed, winemaking is still an unnatural process, with lots and lots of intervention by humans. The lack of additives is perhaps the most interesting and dangerous. Sulfates are used extensively to manage unwanted biological influences and preserve fruit flavours in the wine. The lack of them can play havoc with quality of the wine as well as massively shortening its shelf life. This can be partly managed by using screw caps or aluminium cans to stop oxygen getting into the wine, which is usually mopped up by those now missing sulfites. But the question is, aluminium cans and screw caps? How natural is that? Without sulfur, the wine produced will be far more varied, with a larger range of wines produced, each batch reflecting its own journey, before being blended with the others. The wine will reflect the terroir, as far as weather is concerned, and mostly the weather just before harvest, and also within the confines of the decisions like picking times. Some wines will have random oxidation, others unique aromas from diseased fruit and wild fermentations. Personally, I don't think this is a problem, as long as the purchaser knows they are buying a risk. And for a fanatical wine nut who gets a bit bored with the consistency of one wine after the next, it can provide its own exhilaration. Natural wines are the Russian roulette of the wine world, but perhaps with more Mr. Hyde's than Dr. Jekyll's. It may make wines that don't get anywhere near their potential, but when they do, there is much to be discussed. That finishes the spotlight. Natural wines. I've had a few sulfur-free wines in my time, and I haven't been blown away by them, but it is a new category. Okay, the next clue for our mystery wine region. And as I said earlier, Chenin Blanc is the grape variety used in the Côte d'Ion, which is a sub-region of this area. For celebrated whites, Savonnaise, southwest of Angers, is the appellation to use, making concentrated and long-lasting examples and good vintages, also from Chenin Blanc. About a third of the vineyard area, though, is Cabernet Franc, and is increasingly favoured by growers in the region. Cabernet Franc is also responsible for, although Cabernet Sauvignon can be used, for the region's more refined and long-lasting rosés, and I have had some lovely rosés from down here. This can be quite sweet, but balanced with high acidity, which can give it quite longevity. Lighter red wines come from the Gamay grape. If we think about that, I'm after a sub-region from the Loire. I'm going to give you the answer after our interview, which is coming up next with Simon Tam on Chinese wine. Hi, I'm here with Simon Tam in Hong Kong, looking out over the harbour. How are you, Simon?
I'm extremely well. It's a bit of a grey old day out here. Sorry, we couldn't turn the sunshine on for you, especially coming from freezing UK.
Yeah, it's all right. It's all right. At least as I can see the harbour. My hotel room, all I can see is an apartment block.
So. It's actually a fake view of the harbour. You can buy pictures of the harbour quite very easily in Hong Kong to stick on your windows.
Just like posters. What it is?
Yeah, that's what it is.
Excellent. What we're going to be doing today is talking about Chinese wine and the Chinese wine regions. I must admit, I don't know too much about China as a wine producing country, but I know, for example, the Canadians are in there showing the Chinese how to produce ice wine and things like that. But do you want to give us a big overview of China?
Oh, absolutely. You know, a little known fact, and I think this is probably the biggest shocker on the planet Earth, is that China actually produces more wine than the whole of Australia and has been for the last three vintages.
I knew that they were one of the biggest grape producers.
Wine grapes and wine producers. Wine grape specific. And on top of that, China, the figure is not entirely reliable, but somewhere in the vicinity of 15 to 20-25% of bulk wines to be blended with domestic production. Now, that's pretty hefty. I think adding and compounding that, the fact that very few bottles of Chinese-made wines are made it outside of China and only really seen in cliché Chinese restaurants as far north as Verona in Italy and as far south as Buenos Aires Chinese restaurants. Two and two, four and four put together means that there is a Chinese wine industry. Chinese are drinking wine quite ferociously, actually. And in terms of wine regions, by and far, most of the wines have always been made in and around Beijing in the northern part of the China, where in winter it gets down to minus 20, where the vines had to be buried a few, tens of centimeters down so that they survive the harsh winter. But more recently, and in the very high profile, joint ventures between Chateau Lafite and the Chinese government, where they set up this wonderful vineyard in Shaanxi province, Shandong province, I beg your pardon. Shandong province is northeast. Okay, so there is a little bit of a coastal sort of region, so that we'll watch this space. But the Chinese industry has actually been going for a few centuries, believe it or not. In the years gone by, was always sort of used as a bit of a health tonic, and or in the 1892, I think, was actually where the first winery was founded with a joint venture partner, namely a cognac producer. All of that, it's given Chinese long, not terribly well-known, certainly overshadowed by France and the rest of Europe and indeed New World countries, a sustainable wine industry.
And Chinese grape varieties, they've got their own grape varieties. I've heard of Noble Dragon. Is that right?
There are a lot of weird and wonderful, wicked grape varieties that quite simply, when you translate it into sort of English, makes no sense. It's a little bit like there's a Portuguese grape variety called a fly's dropping.
A fly's dropping?
Yeah, flies, yes. So But these, there are a lot of vinifera varieties, but I think one of the things that, you know, also very interesting in China is that not just vinifera, but also all sorts of, you know...
you mean Vitis vinifera?
Vitis vinifera varieties, but also the other varieties that, for example, glory vines, for example, you know, decorative vines that really produce not a hell of a lot of fruit at all. There are also a lot of mutated varieties, species as well in China. But by and far, in a more than sort of a more contemporary wine world in China, we're looking at primarily French selected clones and then sort of nurtured and propagated in China. So the likes of Cabernet Sauvignon, true Cabernet Sauvignon, true Merlot, true Chardonnay, Semillon, Crucian, Muscat, this sort of great variety. Rieslings, it's debatable whether it's true Riesling or one of those sort of funny Riesling or Welsh Riesling or it's not even Riesling at all. But I think what is very interesting is that, you know, grape varieties is very important in the West, indeed most part of the world. But, you know, in China, it really is about the quality of wine at a price and also the fact that it is made in China. And I think that makes it quite culturally significant because there are a lot of people in China. Not all of them have got huge disposable income. They are very proudly Chinese. So when you have wine, which is primarily a Western lifestyle, that is affordable and it's made in China, you have no shortages of marketing opportunity, you know, in a fast-growing economy like China.
Are they quite parochial about their consumption?
Extremely parochial, much more so than the Italians. I mean, the Piemontese will never drink a glass of wine from Valpolicella and vice versa. What is very interesting is that, you know, made in China, it may not be all that significant as a brand concept elsewhere in the world, but in China, it reigns absolute resonance with everybody and everybody. And I think also what is very important also to remember is that it is a big nation of people. You know, we invented fireworks, we invented debatably whether it's us or Marco Polo navigation systems and charting the sky, the night sky and so on. So there's a lot of proudness. Now, does it mean that there is absolutely no opportunities for imports? Well, no, because one day, sooner or later, the 10 or so very powerful brands in China, you know, they would they serve the purpose of educating and growing and nurturing a new generation and or, you know, reinforcing an established generation of wine lovers. And one day, sooner or later, when the economy grows and is growing, you know, by leaps and bounds at the moment, income per capita goes up, Western lifestyle increasingly permeates and diffuses itself into Chinese culture, it is inevitable that the Chinese wine-loving, you know, platform would grow to a much more international perspective.
What sort of styles of wine are being produced?
Well, that's an extraordinarily good question. I think, you know, for white wine, there are dry wines, there are semi-dry wines, and then, of course, there are ice wines, a lot of which are made actually by the Cabot glaze method. So if you've got a couple of Cabot glaze.
I haven't heard that term.
Yeah, Cabot glaze. So you pick the grapes, not necessarily while it's growing, you know, still evolving. When you pick, you know, at minus 6 degrees, which is what the accord is between Austria, Germany and Canada, you know, grapes, they're going to be picked frozen on the vines at a minimum of 6 degrees minus and before it could be, you know, termed ice wine. And then, of course, there are, you know, a whole ocean of red wine made with 20% plus, give or take, of imported bulk wines that are being blended with domestic production.
Just interested in the blending of foreign wines into Chinese wines. Why do they blend the wines in?
Well, the blending of foreign wines used to be the wine lake of Europe and more recently South America, Australia. It's primarily to give the wine a little bit more structure, primarily because, you know, viticulturally, China is still catching up, keeping in mind that it's one of the oldest economies of the world, like right next to Italy, Portugal, Spain, and Greece, where, you know, farming, it's all about yield. It's not always about quality. And, you know, when you have international producers such as Australia, where yield is limited, more or less, depends on how much you're paying per litre internationally, you know, you could actually glean a fair amount of reward and fair amount of positive contribution to the finished blend. I think more important...
Well, so are you saying that Chinese wine is high yielding and by having a lower yielding wine blended in, it just gives it a bit of guts?
It's not always about high yielding. It is always about flavor. And I think, you know, when you see that, you know, if you are making a spaghetti dish in Iceland, where tomatoes are not terribly ripe, what do? You import it. And so that's exactly what we're looking at for China. And I think the other thing that is also very, very important to point out is the fact that Chinese actually drink a bucket load of wines, much more so than what the current domestic vineyards can actually supply, and hence the imports. And I think that is much more realistic view of it than sort of looking at you know, wine from a very scientific you know, perspective of blending structure for length and for all the other sort of winey-minded concepts.
If you look at a world map, the reason my company is called 3050 is because grapes generally grow between latitudes 30 and 50 degrees latitude, and you know, subject to certain other climatic conditions and whether you're continental and all that sort of stuff. But if you draw a 30-50 degree line, it goes smack through China. And I'm just surprised that you say that they don't ripen the grapes enough in China, because, you know, we're in Hong Kong. Across the ditch is China, effectively, or new territories. And it's pretty hot here at the moment. So I would have thought there's enough energy coming in to ripen grape.
That's an extremely good point. You know, the whole concept of 30-50 latitude north, you know, big swag of it goes right across the northern central part of China. The biggest problem are two. One is the fact that, you know, we're looking at an extraordinarily large continental landmass, much, much larger than any part of Europe, many, many less rivers, many, many less lakes, many, many less, you know, wonderful aspects and attitudes that moderates the mesal environment. And at the same time, we also have an extremely, basically, it's a desert, you know, all the way up north that actually blows horrifically, you know, into China. Sandstorm, it's the main feature of anybody living north of Shanghai. You know, you just basically have to clean your car filter and windows and make sure you have with windows wind up every year just before the storm hits. Otherwise, you're in deep trouble with a vacuum cleaner. That also gets clogged up and so on and so forth. So I think that is one thing. But also the other thing, too, is that it's actually landscape. Latitude is just one thing. And then, of course, you know, you've got, you know, vineyard areas of wines or vineyards like those in Bali, for example. You know, they actually crop as many as four times a year. So the French winemaker down there actually makes four vintages a year, you know. So latitude is just one thing. And then the other thing is about finding soil. And then when you're looking at a north continental climate in a big piece of land, finding, you know, labor, finding workmen to go and actually live there and living the life of not even luxury, but going into a life of desertship, it's something else altogether.
I've got some maps I use at tastings that show the temperature, upper and lower temperature bands of where wines are typically grown around the world. And there, it is true that that band does contract as you go through China, and I presume it's because of the coldness north and maybe the heat further south. But there's still quite a big chunky band there. One of the reasons that I've always thought that China is producing one is partly to do with government edict about don't use rice for alcohol, use grapes because they grow in pretty horrible locations and they like horrible locations where normal farm land isn't appropriate. Is that true or?
Yeah, no, it's very, very much the case. But then I think, you know, if you look at the relative proximity of, say, the Douro River, the Douro Valley to sort of population, you know, it is only a couple of hours drive from the city of Oporto, which is one of the largest busiest European ports in the world. You know, but that is not the case in China. So it actually becomes a little bit of a chicken first or egg first. Are there any great lands, terroir, using a much bantered around word for winemaking, for grape growing? Yes, there are. But are people going to go there and live there? No. I think the other thing, too, is that there is still a lot of, I mean, China as an economy has only really joined the WTO a few years ago, and its topography and its climatology mapping is still at its very, very infant sort of a stage. What would be interesting is to see in another in 5 years' time, we're going to see a lot more, you know, partnerships, the likes of the Chateau Lafite in China, where they will bring in a couple of centuries of know-how, a little bit more satellite imagery, a little bit more, you know, core sampling to help them determine what else, where else rather in China are going to be suitable for winemaking. And more, and especially, of course, the other thing too, of course, is that, you know, when you're establishing a winery, it would be kind of nice to actually pay the winemaker a reasonable amount of salary that says, you know what, you're going to be stuck there for 4 months of the year, but the other, you know, other 8 months of the year, you can go and party the hell you like.
Is that not what happens at the moment?
No.
Touched on a couple of regions. You've said sort of around Beijing and north east China. What sort of producers should people keep an eye out for? Because in the UK, I've seen things like Great Wall of China, which I wasn't horribly impressed with. And I've seen a couple of other Chinese wines, which they've been okay, but they haven't really blown my mind too much. Is there who are the good producers?
Well, look, I think to be fair, quality is always relative to price. And I firmly believe, having done tastings over the years and chairing competitions of just wines made in China, that for the price, for the value, I think you can't do better in Chinese wines. If you compare wines for the same price coming out of Italy, coming out of France, those wines are undrinkable. Wines made in China, possibly, maybe not necessarily exclusively because of the imported bulk wine blending from these sort of sunshine-driven New World countries, actually very, very, more than palatable. At a price, it's enjoyable. So I think it needs to be put in some sort of right perspective for any sort of further comparisons to be made. I think also more importantly, you know, the likes of Dynasty, the likes of Great Wall, the likes of Huadong, and you know, producers like that, collectively are representing around about 50% of China's production. Now, that's pretty substantial. These wines are very technically sound. These wines may not give you that sort of warm and fuzzy, this is really great. I've got to have like 10 more glasses of it. Or, sorry, half glasses, because that 10 glasses would be irresponsible, children. But I think there are also a lot of producers that simply don't have the international reach and the capability to market themselves. So companies such as Thailand, Taiwan, companies such as Bao Long Bao, which is from just outside of Beijing, companies such as, I mentioned briefly before, Huadong, which has had a number of Australian supremo technical consultants making some pretty smart Chardonnays. Companies such as Tailian, I mentioned Tailian before. They also produce a pretty spectacular Chardonnay with a Pernod Ricard connection from around the world. So,
is that the one you gave me? You've given me a bottle to try later on.
Yes, so. that is the Chardonnay that won the best wine from China in the 2009 Cathay Pacific International Wine and Spirits Competition in Hong Kong. Wow. Absolutely, yeah. I hope you enjoy that.
Well, so do I. I'll, at the end of this podcast, I'll give a tasting note for it.
So all in all, they are unsung heroes. And I think it's just really requiring a little bit more time. And I think one of the other issues is that I think wine lovers in the West are in a bit of a hurry, always sort of demanding and extracting, you know, comparable quality wines from China, comparable to France, top wines, to Italy, top wines, to top Italian wines and so on. And I think the reality is that China is a relatively new industry. Wine industry is relatively new. It's been around for probably no more than 20 years commercially on any sort of scale. It possibly only has consultants and university degrees, taught by traveling wine lecturers and professors from around the world in the last sort of 15. And very, very few winemakers from China are able to travel overseas to learn, quite unlike the Australian flying winemaker scenario. So all in all, I think, you know, we're doing a good job. Just give us a bit more time. Don't be in a bloody hurry. I understand that just going back a month ago, I think one of UK's largest supermarkets, you know, desire and wishes to import wines from China. And I hope that would be the beginning of a new renaissance for the Chinese wine industry.
Where do you think Chinese wine will be in, say, 5 or 10 years' time?
In 5 or 10 years' time, I believe the Chinese wine industry, first and foremost, I think Chinese wine consumers are extraordinarily demanding. So they will continue to push the quality and drive the quality upwards and upwards and upwards, and demand orders from local wineries. Secondly, I think in another 5 years' time, and with a, you know, the membership in World Trade Organizations, and already some of my wine professor friends in China already teaching as far afield as South Africa, as South Australia, and I understand that there is a extremely healthy exchanges of intellectual, you know, expertise being bantered around the world, and that's very healthy. I think also, not least of all, there are some wonderful, prolific wine consultants or viticultural consultants that actually work the world platform, and surely China would benefit. And I think as the economy grows stronger, the farmer's mentality to produce quantity instead of quality will be only be rewarded by higher financial reward, and hopefully that would be the tipping point or beginning of a tipping point of quality-minded viticulture, which of course provides, as we know, the raw material for the end product. So I believe that is well underway. I also believe that there are a couple other producers such as Grace Vineyard that are, you know, just quite methodical in their marketing of their wines from around the world.
They're the ones with the funky like it's a red building, isn't it, with red roofs.
Right.
I've seen photos of it. Looks very nice.
No, they really are reinvesting in their own roots. Take a bit of a pun there. I think there's some really, really good operators, and that will just becoming more and more so.
Okay then, Simon, I think we'll wrap it up there.
Thank you
very much.
Welcome.
Hope you enjoyed that. I'm still trying to get my head around China as a wine region for a while now. You may recall we spoke to Richard Smart about China way back in show 139, but I still struggle with it. So to make it a bit simple for me, I've sort of been looking at the maps and trying to understand what's going on. It does sound that some of the potential wine regions in the northwest of the country are very isolated, while those in the northeast of the country can have quite high humid climate because they're quite close to the sea. Some of the more sensible places for grape growing aren't being used because I think they're being focused in on food production. In the interview, I did say that I would review a Chardonnay, but sadly, I tasted it, but to be honest, the wine was pretty awful, and I wasn't quite sure if it was a fault, because I couldn't quite find what the fault was. It had a slightly dirty, reductive taste to it, but it didn't quite taste reductive to me, so I wasn't quite sure what's going on. So in the end, I decided not to review the wine and give you any tasting notes on it. Suffice to say that it wasn't the best Chinese wine I'd had, and I have had better. I presume it's something wrong with the bottle. Rightio, just before we finish up the show, just some feedback. If you've been listening to the show and you like the show, it'd be great to get some feedback, particularly if you could put a review up maybe in iTunes, or if you use some other podcasting message board, that'd be fantastic. If you've got something negative or positive and you don't want to do that, do send me an email. My email address is chris.scott@3050.co.uk. Apart from that, the answer to our mystery region, it was, of course, Anjou. Not too hard, not too easy, though, either. So a good one for a challenge. And before we finish up, the last thing is our quote. And this week, it comes from the book Journal to Stella by Jonathan Swift. We were to do more business after dinner, but after dinner is after dinner. An old saying and true. Much drinking, little thinking. Until next week. Cheers and good drinking.
The UK Wine Show is a weekly podcast brought to you by 3050, the wine tasting company. The show is produced by Chris Scott and the news is read by Jane Scott. To listen to other shows, visit ukwineshow.co.uk. Thank you for listening.